Today is Wednesday, September the 4th, 2024. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key. Big Tech has been collecting and aggregating your personal data. Do you know how Big Tech companies and our government are using your personal data? We have been bringing computer news, hardware and software reviews, guest interviews, and news of user group meetings for the past 40-plus years. The Personal Computer Show is a three-time winner of the prestigious National Computer Press Awards. Our only advocacies are consumerism and the First Amendment. I welcome you, the listeners, to provide feedback as to what you want to hear. Address your suggestions to Hank at pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.live. That's PRN.live, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.live on the Internet. You can leave us a message with your questions or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Is this even legal? Target ads based on what potential customers said near device microphones. Publication 404 Media previously reported Cox Media Group was advertising a service that claimed to target ads based on what potential customers said near device microphones. Media giant Cox Media Group, that's CMG, says it can target advertisements based on what potential customers said out loud near device microphones, and explicitly points to Facebook, Google, Amazon, and Bing as CMG partners, according to a CMG presentation obtained by 404 Media. CMG sent to prospective companies advertised capability which it calls active listening. In December, 404 Media first reported on active listening's existence using pictures from CMG's website before the company deleted that information. Google has kicked CMG from its advertising partners program after 404 Media asked Google for comment. The CMG Media Group market agency admits it listens to user voice data using its active listening software via smartphone microphones. It reportedly, in partnership with Google, Facebook, and Amazon, uses its software to channel the right ads to users. As part of the agency's defense strategy, it claims that the disclaimer of its software is often included in the fine print of the terms of services agreement when downloading a new app or update. Have you ever stumbled on an ad on social media or while browsing that feature, the item that you were searching for on the web, or talking to someone about over a phone call? Turns out, there's more to this than meets the eye. According to a new report by 404 Media, a marketing agency admitted it listens to user voice data using its active listening software via smartphone microphones. Consequently, it uses the data to channel the right Facebook and Google ads to customers. The agency reportedly has access to more than 470 sources, including Microsoft's LinkedIn. The market agency has been wrapped up in this controversial situation since December 2023, and now new details in a pitch deck reveal that Cox Media Group leverages AI capabilities to capture real-time intent data by listening to our conversations using its active listening feature. This caused a ripple effect, prompting Meta to investigate and examine the agency's term of service to determine whether it has been using users' data without their consent, breaching their partnership agreement, according to the pitch deck. Advertisers can pair this voice data with the behavioral data to target in-market consumers. This caused a ripple effect, prompting Meta to investigate and examine the agency's terms of service to determine whether it has been using users' data without their consent, breaching their partnership agreement, according to the pitch deck. Advertisers can pair this voice data with behavioral data to target in-market consumers. Amazon refuted claims that it embroidered in the marketing agency's privacy fiasco and further stated that it doesn't intend to seek its services. The company warned it would take legal action if it discovered that one of its partners violated its term of service. In a since-deleted blog by the marketing agency, it stated as follows. We know what you're thinking. Is this even legal? It is legal for phones and devices to listen to you. When a new app download or update prompts consumers with a multi-page term of user agreement, somewhere in the fine print, active listening is often included. Interestingly, the marketing agency claims that the presence and use of the listening software are often included somewhere in the fine print of the terms of user agreement when you're downloading a new app or update. The Starliner spacecraft has started to emit strange noises. I don't know what's making it. On Saturday, NASA astronaut Butch Wilmore noticed some strange noises emanating from a speaker inside the Starliner spacecraft. I've got a question about Starliner, Wilmore radioed down to Mission Control at Johnson Space Center in Houston. There is a strange noise coming through the speaker. I don't know what's making it. Wilmore said he was not sure if there was some oddity in the connection between the station and the spacecraft causing the noise, or something else. He asked the flight controllers in Houston to see if they could listen to the audio inside the spacecraft. A few minutes later, Mission Control radioed back that they were linked up via hardline to listen to audio inside Starliner, which has now been docked to the International Space Station for nearly 3 months.
Houston, I'm 2. I've got a question about Starliner.
Houston's with you, Butch. Go ahead.
There's a strange noise coming through the speaker, and I didn't know if you could connect into the Starliner and let me keep my and let you hear. I don't know what's making it, but I don't know if it's something that maybe connected between here and there making that happen, but anyway, can you do that?
We can configure that, Butch. Give us a minute, and I'll call you back when it's ready.
Okay.
Station Houston on 2, we're configured for audio via hardline and CST, if you want to give us a call.
Okay, and it's, I'm in Starliner, and how do you read?
5x5, how many?
Okay, I'm going to put the mic up next to the speaker.
Copy.
Hear that?
At negative, Butch, we did not hear anything. All right, Butch, that one came through. It was kind of like a pulsing noise, almost like a sonar ping.
Yeah, I'll do it one more time, and I'll just scratch your heads and see if you can figure out what's going on. Here we go. Hey, over to you. I'll figure it out.
Yep, good recording. Thanks, Butch. We will pass it on to the team and let you know what we find. And Butch, just to make sure I'm on the same page, this is emanating from the speaker in Starliner. You don't notice anything else, any other noises, any other weird configs in there?
Very nice. Everything else is off.
Great. Thank you.
Wilmore, apparently floating in Starliner, then put his microphone up to the speaker inside Starliner. Shortly thereafter, there was an audible pinging that was quite distinctive. All right, Butch, that one came through. Mission Control radio up to Wilmore. It was kind of like a pulsing noise, almost like a sonar ping. I'll do it one more time, and I'll let you all scratch your heads and see if you can figure out what's going on, Wilmore replied. The odd sonar-like audio then repeated itself. All right, over to you. Course, if you can figure it out. A recording of this audio and Wilmore conversation with Mission Control was captured and shared by a Michigan-based meteorologist named Rob Dale. It was not immediately clear what was causing the odd and somewhat eerie noise. As Starliner flies to the space station, it maintains communications with the space station via a radio frequency system. Once docked, however, there is a hard-line umbilical that carries audio. Astronauts notice such oddities in space from time to time. For example, China's first human spaceflight in 2003, astronaut Yang Liwei said he heard what sounded like an iron bucket being knocked by a wooden hammer while in orbit. Later, scientists realized the noise was due to small deformations in the spacecraft due to a difference in pressure between its inner and outer walls. This weekend's sonar-like noises most likely have been a benign cause, and Wilmore certainly did not sound frazzled. But the odd noises are worth noting given the challenges that Boeing and NASA have had with the debut crewed flight of Starliner, including substantial helium leaks in flight and failing thrusters. NASA announced a week ago that due to uncertainty about the flyability of Starliner, it would come home without its original crew of Wilmore and Sonny Williams. Starliner is now due to fly back autonomously to Earth on Friday, September the 6th. Wilmore and Williams will return to Earth next February, flying aboard a Crew Dragon spacecraft scheduled to launch with just two astronauts later this month. Creativity is made, not generated. We have been watching the ongoing storm of excitement, overpromising and disaster with a look of disgust. But few companies have come out and said what lots of ordinary people are disdaining: generative AI. Procreate, who had the resolve to speak out first. The CEO of Procreate, James Cuda, took to social media to address the question head on. Is the popular drawing app working on generative AI features? Cuda, who says he doesn't like getting in front of the camera, rather bluntly states his disdain for the technology. We're never going to go there. Creativity is made, not generated. I don't like what's happening in the industry, he says. I don't think what it's doing to artists. We're not going to be introducing any generative AI into our products. Our products are always designed and developed with the idea that a human will be creating something. Cuda admits that they don't know exactly where this all is heading, but remain convinced that they're on the right path. It's quite refreshing to hear someone come out and say those words, especially from a creativity-based tech company. After all, Microsoft, Adobe, and now even Apple are all in on adding AI assistance and generation to nearly every creative task. I don't know that Procreate's stance on AI will spark a larger movement to stand firm against the ongoing AI creep. Heck, it may even turn out to be a mistake for the company. It certainly takes some courage, though, and likely at least a modicum of knowledge that Procreate's users agree with him. I say they're onto something. Creativity is made, not generated. Generative AI is ripping the humanity out of things. Built on a foundation of theft, the technology is steering us towards a barren future. We think machine learning is a compelling technology with a lot of merit, but the path generative AI is on is wrong for us. We're here for the humans. We're not chasing a technology that is a moral threat to our greatest jewel, human creativity. In this technological rush, this might make us an exception or seem at risk of being left behind. But we see this road less traveled as the more exciting and fruitful one for our community. Microsoft won't allow you to uninstall Recore on Windows 11 after all. Originally, we learned that Microsoft may allow you to uninstall its upcoming Recore capability from Windows 11. This was based on the settings present in a recent optional Windows 11 update that was rolled out in the European Union, that's the EU. This build offered users a toggle in the control panel, enabling them to get rid of the controversial capability altogether. However, Microsoft now says that it does not plan to empower customers in this way after all. So, what's all the fuss about? It turns out that the ability to uninstall Recore is actually a bug in Windows 11. and that the Redmond tech firm does not intend to give users this authority after all. In a statement to the publication The Verge, senior Windows product manager Brandon LeBlanc had the following to say, "We are aware of an issue where recall is incorrectly listed as an option under the Turn Windows Features On or Off dialog in Control Panel. This will be fixed in an upcoming update." The situation did seem a bit fishy from the get-go, considering that the option to uninstall recall was not showing up for all users and was not a part of any Canary release either. At the time, we speculated that this could be a change only for European users to comply with the European Union's Digital Markets Act, but that is not the case either. When is recall rolling out to Windows 11 users? For those unaware, recall is a rather major Windows 11 feature that was originally intended to be released alongside Copilot Plus. It was designed to continually take screenshots of your PC and make the content present in these visuals searchable so that you can recall past information through natural language queries. However, the capability turned out to be extremely controversial from a privacy perspective, and Microsoft eventually had to delay it after it was revealed that the company locally stores all your screenshots and related information in plain text. As it stands, recall is slated to launch sometime next month in Windows 11 Insiders channels in a much improved state. Once the company is confident about general availability based on user feedback and general security, the feature will launch globally on Copilot Plus PCs. That said, the latest news about recall being uninstallable may be a turnoff for many. How often you should restart your phone? Do you ever turn your phone off and turn it back on? Once a week? Many experts recommend restarting your phone at least once a week. This practice helps clear out background processes that may be draining your battery and can improve overall performance, particularly those who use their phones heavily or experience frequent lag, may benefit from restarting their devices daily. However, this is not necessary for everyone. Considering we're on our phones all the time, or at the very least glancing at them several times an hour, to see if anyone is trying to reach us, it's no wonder we never turn them off. Even if we mute them while we're sleeping or in a meeting, having access is second nature, even allowing certain people's phone number to come through no matter what in case of an emergency. However, should we be shutting them down for a bit each day or at the very least restarting them? Some users, particularly those who use their phones heavily or experience frequent lag, may benefit from restarting their devices daily. However, this is not necessary for everyone. There are benefits of regular restarts. Improved performance. Restarting can help eliminate glitches and slow down caused by background apps and processes. Regular restarts can prevent apps from running amok and draining your battery unnecessarily. And then there are security updates. Restarting your phone can help apply security updates more effectively, ensuring your device remains secure. When to restart? If you notice your phone is lagging, apps are misbehaving, or you've experiencing connectivity issues, a restart can often resolve these problems. Even if your phone seems to be functioning well, a weekly restart can be a good maintenance habit, akin to giving your car an oil change. According to Reader's Digest, our phones most definitely need to reboot and refresh to stay working at top notch. Unlike computers, our smartphones have a basic hard and fast rule we should all live by. According to Reader's Digest, once a week we should turn our phones off completely for at least 1 minute. That's it. It's that simple. T-Mobile also suggests that regular restarts can help resolve connectivity issues. Restarting our phones weekly helps them retain memory, helps prevent crashes, keeps them running more smoothly, and prolongs battery life, according to Reader's Digest. Meanwhile, according to Forbes, daily shutdowns for a few minutes or longer not only clear out your phone's cache and help prevent hacking, but it's also good for us to have a few moments of digital detox, if you will. Basically, it's healthy for both us humans and our smartphones, uninterrupted time to have breaks from each other. T-Mobile also suggests that regular restarts can help resolve connectivity issues, while the exacting frequency can vary based on individual usage. A good rule of thumb is to restart your phone at least once a week to maintain optimal performance and security. Presenting the IT Pro Series with Benjamin Rockwell.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where we talk about computers, the workplace, and IT professionals. The movie Jurassic Park, yet amongst the witty dialogue, the fantastic scenery, and the dinosaurs, actually has a tale of IT professionals that still exists much to this day. John Hammond, the creator of the park, made a number of bad decisions along the way, but none is underscored by this constant reference to "I spared no expense." He gushes over this so many times during the movie. He talks about the Chilean sea bass, spared no expense. The voice narration, Richard Kiley, I think is the name, no expense. He goes over the self-driving cars, the island itself, even the ice cream, spared no expense. But even in a number of these items, we actually see that this is a lie. Even Hammond admits that his aspirations along the way in that ice cream scene, they were kind of, it's hidden away, but kind of that he wanted to be the next P.T. Barnum. Yeah, the greatest showman. So one obvious area where Hammond spared expense is the IT professional. Now, this is the heavy set, and he's played very unlikable, Dennis Nedry. And the movie paints him, the IT professional, as both a hacker and a thief, a greedy villain, a glutton, and so much more. It's actually clear from many parts that Nedry was actually someone who was in over his head. He didn't think of the risks of powering down containment fences, of the danger of the little dinosaurs that actually killed him, and most importantly, the overall scope of the job of programming, not something small like a preserve, but an entire island. Now, let's put aside the fact that Dennis Nedry clearly was in over his head from the beginning and all the way through, and in some ways through his ignorance of not understanding things. Leave aside the fact that in his little programming cubicle, he was either not shown the big picture or really more likely he was unaware of it. And this itself comes down to something that every nerd has dealt with to some level, and it's called scope creep. This is a term you may have heard of. You may have used this term. You may be aware of scope creep, but IT pros deal with this not on a just occasional basis, but constantly. I bid on a wiring job. This was about 25 years ago, and the company owner said, okay, it's going to be here, 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 and here. And I went through, and I measured things out, and then said, okay, this is going to be here, this is going to be there, we're going to need this much cable, we're going to need this many connectors, and things like that. And then the owner asked for a couple of different things to be thrown in, and a couple of more. And a few more. And I added a new price tag for some of these things along the way. And he kept on bumping this up more and more. And it was getting to be something that was going to be a small effort. And it moved into nearly doubling it. And it was doubling it through the matter of about 15, 20 extra network lines. But each of them was far harder than the rest, and He relied on what I could easily accuse him of misdirection about what existed. I could easily come back and say, wow, this was really not in any of the scope of this. Now, in that particular project, I didn't lose money, but I lost profit. I didn't really have money coming out of my pocket, but I couldn't make more than just a bare break even, a little bit more. It was profit, but it wasn't interesting profit, what I try to normally do. In another position, I bid on a job, and this was for a department in a huge school district, I'll say second largest in the country. And a similar thing happened where they kept adding in more features. And they also said, oh, this was included in the scope. And I would say, well, no, not really. I look at the original, and the original doesn't have this. Well, we need this in here. Okay, so that's going to cost some extra. No, that's in the original scope. That's what we originally asked you. And it's your failing if you don't see that in there. So, yeah. Along the way, actually, it was something very telling. The original website disappeared. They hid some of the things, and they added in more things they said were originally in there, and they clearly weren't. Look, even as we work with projects as IT professionals, or anywhere else, scope creep does happen. The nerds will have ideas, the customer epiphanies, and the team will develop new goals, and what was once a simple project will have hurdles along the way that nobody had ever expected. I've since learned that when developing any project, I need to prepare for both the expected and unexpected scope creep. I need to prepare contingencies up front for modular inserts of new layers of scope that were not planned before but could show up there. I currently need to plan for time and energy to expand in future iterations beyond what the project is. Dennis Nedry was sold on a simple zoo with a few extra exotic animals. Nerds, be aware that the scope will grow and make provisions for expansion, both in your bids but also in your programming. Project managers, please make room for scope creep in your timelines and your budgets. That is the fair way. That is the proper way to treat your nerds. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Pros and cons of single sign-on with Google and Facebook. Using platforms like Google or Facebook offers both advantages and disadvantages. Single sign-on, better known by the acronym SSO, is a technology that lets you sign in to multiple services with just a single set of credentials. SSO gets a bit complicated behind the scenes. But the short version is that when you create an account with a non-Google service through Google, instead of getting a normal set of credentials, a token is created instead. This token is a small file controlled by Google that lets you sign in seamlessly into your new account. As long as you've signed into Google, you can access any sites it holds the tokens to. It's a pretty nifty bit of technology and saves a lot of time and hassle with passwords. When you create a new account online, you'll have the option to sign up with Google, Facebook, or another service. As tempting as that is, you may want to avoid it and create an account based on your own email address or username instead. There is a convenience factor with single sign-on. It allows users to log into multiple services with just one set of credentials, significantly reducing the hassle of remembering numerous passwords. This can be especially beneficial for those who frequently create new accounts. However, there is a price for this convenience, and one you may not want to pay. A strong password is an effective security tool, deterring attackers and preventing access. It's a case of it's better to have each of your accounts secured independently, even if one is breached, the others will be safe. When using single sign-on, you're reducing all these smaller protections to a single point of failure. If somehow your main account is breached, All those tokens are now controlled by the attacker, and you cannot easily change that. They will have free reign over all the associated accounts. It's a security nightmare. There is the speed of registration with single sign-on. Signing up for new services can be done in just a few clicks, as personal information such as name and email can be automatically populated from your Google or Facebook profile. With a single sign-on, there's profile synchronization. Changes made to your profile, like updating a profile picture on Google or Facebook, can automatically reflect across all linked accounts, ensuring consistency. There is the security features in major platforms. Google and Facebook have robust security measures in place, which can provide a level of protection against unauthorized access. But swearing off single sign-on does not necessarily mean saying goodbye to convenience. You can simply use a password manager instead, a program that stores and automatically fills in passwords for you. These are just as easy to use as single sign-on, but come without the negative security implications. Even if your password manager was cracked somehow, you could always reset your accounts yourself, as you still have control. What are the risks in single sign-on? If your Google or Facebook account is compromised, all linked accounts could be at risk. This creates a vulnerability where a breach in one account can lead to breaches in others. There is limited control over shared information when using single sign-on. Users may have less control over what personal information is shared with third-party applications. This can include sensitive data beyond just your email and name. Speaking of control, even without the threat of a massive breach, you may not want to have big tech sign in for you. For one, you're handing control over your accounts to a service that may decide to lock you out. Horror stories abound of people being locked out of their Facebook and Gmail accounts with little recourse to getting back in. If you're using single sign-on, you'll also lose access to your other accounts. There is a dependency factor on third-party services. Relying on a single account for multiple services means that if you ever decide to delete your Google or Facebook account, you may lose access to all associated services. And let's not forget, there is increased tracking. Using single sign-on can make it easier for companies to track user behavior across different platforms, raising privacy concerns. You may want to consider whether you really want big tech to know everywhere you sign in. Their business is all about gathering data for advertisers. And it seems like using them to sign into your accounts is just making things easier for them. For example, Google controls what you see in search results, while according to the publication Wired, Facebook tracks your browsing habits. Letting them know exactly which online service you use is just another data point they can sell. If you're privacy-oriented, there are alternatives that are just as simple to use. Summing all of this up is, while single sign-on with Google and Facebook can enhance convenience and streamline the login process, it also introduces significant security risk and privacy concerns that users should carefully consider. How long do solid-state drives really last? Solid-state drives don't last forever. The NAND flash memory that powers them only has a finite number of write and erase cycles, which means that over time, your solid-state drive will fail. The question is, how long do solid-state drives really last? Do you need to worry about that when you shop, or what other signs to look out for? On average, many solid-state drives may function well for 5 to 10 years before showing signs of failure. However, this estimate can change depending on the particular solid-state drive in question. Things that may prolong or shorten the lifespan of a solid-state drive include the type of NAND flash memory it uses, the workloads it handles, and how often and how heavily it's in use. There's surprisingly little intelligence on the average lifespan of a solid-state drive. Although solid-state drives may function well for up to 10 years, the average solid-state drive will fail sooner than that. And recent studies claim that solid-state drive failure becomes likelier with time more so than with usage. According to a research paper from the University of Toronto and Google, NAND flash drives have a much lower replacement rate, although the lifespan of a solid-state drive might seem fairly ambiguous. Every solid-state drive has an estimated amount of data it can handle before it's at risk of failing. When you shop for a solid-state drive, you often see various specs that estimate how long the solid-state drive should function before things go south. There are three specs that may or may not be given with a product that you buy. There's terabytes written, there's drive rates per day, and mean time between failures. Some manufacturers will list just one of these metrics, while others may list all three. This is why determining how long a solid-state drive can last is not an exact science. After all, each of those metrics refer to something else. Terabytes written is a measure of the total amount of data that can be written to your solid-state drive before it wears out. High terabytes written is good because it translates to better endurance, but you're unlikely to ever exceed the terabytes written on any solid-state drive. Even older drives with a modest 300 terabytes written will last for years and years with normal usage. Then with drive writes per day is another metric used to gauge the endurance of your solid-state drive. It indicates how many times the entire capacity of the solid-state drive can be written to per day over the warranty period of the drive. And mean time between failure, on the other hand, is a reliability metric that refers to the time between failures. Measured in hours in a solid-state drive, it simply estimates how likely it is that your solid-state drive would die during normal operation. For all those metrics, it's important to remember that they're statistical measures that don't guarantee your solid-state drive will live for that long. It's just an estimate, and some solid-state drives will fail in a year while others won't fail at all and will simply be replaced at one point. Hard disk drives. In the early days of consumer solid-state drives, some people claimed that they'd be much less reliable than hard disk drives. But this turned out to be a common PC myth. On the other hand, that same study found that solid-state drives get more uncorrectable errors and bad blocks than hard disk drives, which doesn't necessarily lead to total drive failures. It's more about degradation over a certain period of time. Backblaze, a cloud storage and backup company, also shares some interesting insights on solid-state drive reliability by publishing mid-year reports. In mid-2023, the company was using a whopping total of 3,144 solid-state drives in its storage servers. In the second quarter of 2023, out of those 3,144 solid-state drives, only 8 failed. The company's annualized failure rate, with the acronym AFR, hovered between 0.36% and 1.72%. What's perhaps more interesting is that Backblaze also calculated the average age of failure for solid-state drives. In 2023 report, the company encountered a total of 63 failed solid-state drives. Taking into account power on hours, Backblaze determined that the average age of a solid-state drive was just 14 months. But this data is misleading. The average solid-state drive in Backblaze's entire fleet is just 25 months. With time, the average age of solid-state drives at the time of failure will likely increase. Wanting to determine just how long solid-state drive lasts is especially difficult because almost every single study talk about solid-state drives in the context of data centers, not consumers. It would be hard to measure the exact average lifespan of a consumer solid-state drive, study or not, because there's more to it than just time, although it does seem like time plays the biggest role. Another thing to keep in mind is that many solid-state drives will just never fail. You'll sooner replace your entire system than see the solid-state drive die. Some solid-state drives will fail and some won't, and there's no easy way to predict what will happen to yours. All metrics aside, the age of your solid-state drive is the determining factor in how long it'll last. A drive under heavy usage is therefore likelier to wear out sooner, but one day the solid-state drive will wear out one way or another. Most solid-state drives come with a limited warranty of 3 to 5 years. The rest is up to luck and usage. NAND flash memory. Why it's hard to estimate the average lifespan of an SSD is that there's no universal type of SSD to refer to, depending on the NAND flash memory used in a particular SSD. It may have a higher or lower predicted number of write cycles. Another reason why it's hard to estimate the average lifespan of an SSD is that there's no universal type of SSD to refer to, depending on the NAND flash memory used in a particular solid-state drive. It may have a higher or lower predicted number of write cycles. The types of NAND flash memory in SSDs are SLC, single-level cell. This type of NAND only really appears in enterprise SSDs, such as those used in data centers. It only stores one bit of information per cell, making data retrieval quicker, and its endurance the highest than is MLC, multi-level cell. While the name implies that this type of NAND stores several bits per cell, it's most commonly used for 2 bits per cell. The higher density means that it's easier to produce its larger capacities. Consumer-grade MLC SSDs may have a lower endurance rating, though. And then there's TLC, triple-level cell. This type of memory stores 3 bits per cell. This is the most popular type of NAND in consumer solid-state drives right now, with a good crossover between performance, price, and durability. And last is QLC, quad-level cell. QLC NAND stores 4 bits of data per cell, increasing storage density at a huge cost to endurance. Some manufacturers start using a technique called 3D NAND, increasing density and storage capacity without making the SSD itself bigger. This technology can be used with any type of NAND, from SLC to QLC. Most solid-state drives these days come with TLC NAND, which makes them more affordable but less durable. Presenting Technology Chatter with Benjamin Rockwell and Marty Winston.
Marty Winston joins me now. And Marty, what do you have for us this week?
Oh, this one, well, it doesn't exist in a vacuum. A vacuum exists in it.
Wait, what?
Well, okay. Let me get there. It's the Grabo-powered suction lifter. And as I explain it to you, you'll have seen things this reminds you of.
Okay.
Remember, you've worked in server rooms.
Yes.
You know those four panels that the wiring runs under, right?
Yeah.
And to lift that floor panel up, you take this giant pizza-sized suction cup and put it down there and crank back the suction to lift the thing up, right?
Shove it down hard, had 2 suction cups on it, squeeze it twice, and then just lift. Yeah, the panel comes right up. Kind of the opposite of drop ceilings, the acoustic tiling, all that. It's just flip it on its foot.
If you're putting up wallboard, as I still haven't done, or doing any of that kind of thing, dealing with big panels. And Grabo, well, they call it an electric vacuum lifter, but hey, I'm one of those people, whenever I take a stick vacuum off its charger, you know, I'm an electric vacuum lifter. This is different.
Okay, so
what you're dealing with is an electric motor inside creating vacuum at the suction cups under the control of your fingertip on the button.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And this does a lot of suction. If you've got a big slab of something and you're able to lift it, by the way, it has hooks for shall we say, overhead wire control assistance.
Sure. Okay.
There's enough suction there. You can pick up a slab that weighs, I believe, 350 pounds.
Wow. Okay.
This is the Gravo Pro Lifter 20. It's rechargeable.
Mm-hmm.
It's hefty battery, powers the vacuum pump. The vacuum pump can draw, do your metric conversions, kids, 20 liters of air per minute.
Okay.
Got a 2-liter Coke, 10 of those every minute.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. If you put it on a solid slab and you'd have the muscles to safely handle it, that's enough suction to lift as much as 375 pounds.
Okay. So we're talking, you know, panes of big, big panes of glass.
Marble.
Yeah. Okay. Marble.
Big planes of glass.
I have no idea how much marble weighs. I know it's heavy. I wouldn't want to drop it on my foot or anything like that. But what would be a 3-foot by 10-foot counterweight? Do you have any idea?
About 150, I think.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Now, if you don't have enough muscle to grab its handle and lift it yourself,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to lecture you. It has anchor points for things that can help you lift. You know.
Okay. All right.
A winch or a crane or something. Now, it's built to use with glass, but okay. You better make that glass thicker than 6 millimeters.
Okay.
The suction can kind of warp it.
I didn't think about that. Yeah, so it doesn't have like a dial to do a little bit of suction or a lot of suction?
Well, you could do a little suction, but that can be dangerous if you try it that way.
Sure, okay.
It's also good on ceramic tiles.
Okay,
on sheets of metal, on plastic, on wood. It's good on rough slate. It's good on rough concrete.
Oh, or, nice. Okay.
Yeah. Or you know, for those of you who know me will know that this is where they hooked me. It's also very good on drywall.
That is, and when I start thinking about drywall or as you mentioned, concrete, those are surfaces that are very rough. That's, you know, I would expect it to work really well with glass. I would expect it to work really well with marble. Right. But when you've got
a
something
static suction cup works well enough with glass as well. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's
now, just everybody, this is the Gravo Pro Lifter 20. It's about $300 on Amazon.
Okay. All right.
So how to pick up heavy girl? No, that's not it.
Oh, dear.
I want to point out that there is a danger here, so keep the kids away from it. There's been a few experiences, apparently, of kids putting this on the wall of a house or something as a climb handle.
Ooh, okay.
Okay.
They think they're Spider-Man or something like that. They're going to just like climb up the building.
Kind of, and they can be not strong enough to hold their own grip. And now you got the thing up the wall, or they can get up farther than they can cope with and they'll fall down and because it's the easy way down because they don't know how to reverse the thing.
Sure. Yeah.
So keep kids away from it and don't try it yourself. But if you've got to work with those big, flat, heavy things.
Yeah.
You can't grab it on the edges and move it, and you're going to need 3 or 4 people with you if you can handle the weight.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Instead of finding an easier way to deal with something like the assistance that you get from something like this Gravo.
Mm-hmm.
I like it.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like a very interesting product. It's got a
power tool that none of us has.
You know? Yeah, exactly. And hey, you know, I mean, that is one of the things that we nerds are all about. Hey, there's a new power tool. Really? I don't need to know what it is. Just send it over to me. I'll look at it. I'll use it. I'll find a use for it.
Which of my neighbors has it so I can borrow it and never give it back?
Oh, man. It's always fun talking to you with these a weird myriad of tools. Again, that's the Gravo powered suction lifter. As for now, this is Benjamin Rockwell. That's Marty Winston. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin, and thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region.
Log on to the club website for more information on remote meeting ID. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Online virtual meeting via Jitsi. Website is acgnj.org. King's Bike Computer Club meets Tuesday, September the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West in Brooklyn. For more information, the phone number is 347-278-7320. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation on note-taking apps, Thursday, September the 12th, 2024. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom. Website is nyacc.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, September the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., online virtual meeting via Zoom, and the website is limac.org. The Brookdale Computer Users Group meets Thursday, September the 26th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., online virtual meeting, and the website is bcug.com. TED Ed Connect has a presentation looking at Westchester Geographic Information Systems, where maps meet databases. Tuesday, October the 1st, 2024, meeting time is 7 p.m. In-person general meetings are back. Scarsdale Public Library, 54 Olmsted Road in Scarsdale, zip code 10583. Online virtual meeting via Zoom, wpcug.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN, live streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.live on the Internet. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Michael Horowitz, Benjamin Rockwell, and Marty Winston, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.